Welcome to Create Pod. We're back with another interview episode on the podcast about the art of podcasting. I'm Mike Moody.
And I'm Grant Davis.
This time, talking to Ivy Lee, podcaster here in Austin and an alum of the Spotify SoundUp Accelerator program. So Ivy was chosen to be a part of the program that Spotify put together last year to educate and support women of color in developing podcasts. So Ivy talks a lot about the Spotify program, what she learned there. There are tons of takeaways for podcasters in this episode.
So Ivy's podcast is called FOGO, which is short for Fear of Going Outside. It's actually a very unique show, sort of a hybrid comedy show, narrative storytelling, personal journal kind of thing about her, like it says in the title, fear of going outside and trying to overcome that. She's currently in production of the first season.
I can relate. And like a lot of podcasters we talk to, she's also a writer. She covered the beer beat for a long time for the Austin Chronicle. I think you knew her from
right.
that.
That's yeah. I met her first through my beer podcast doing that.
And she's also a master marketer with a history in marketing and communication. She's just great at all that stuff. So lots to learn from Ivy in this episode. Did I mention she's also a comedian?
It's going to become very apparent.
She does it all, and it was great to learn from her experience. Here's our chat with Ivy Lee. Just tell us a bit about your background as a creator and why you jumped into podcasting with FOGO.
So I have been a writer for a very long time. I used to be the only Asian American spoken word artist in Atlanta. I had a little piece in the Alternative News Weekly over there about it. And I've been working my side hustle has been kind of reporting for a really long time. I actually know Grant because I used to be the beer reporter for the Austin Chronicle when I first moved here. And so I had just like everybody else, I had like a blog. I think the only super trendy thing I never tried was trying to be a DJ, but I definitely blogged.
You tried to also be a DJ?
No, I said that's the only super trendy thing that I did not attempt.
All right, but you still had a DJ name idea, right?
I do. I have a rapper name.
Oh, okay. Not to put you on the spot.
It's Ivy Cat. Right. I had to come up with a rapper name just so that I could be in this like hip hop festival once in Atlanta.
Did you take the stage and rap?
I did.
Did you do the hip hop?
The hippity hip.
Yeah.
The hip hop.
Did you do that?
No.
Sorry.
Mike is my dad.
I have no kids, but I am a constant stream of dad jokes. Apologies.
No, that's what I came for. I'm here for it. I'm here for it now. You know, since I've had kids, like now I think dad jokes are really sexy.
What? My wife most certainly does not.
Yeah.
That was a total joke.
Yeah, okay.
You guys are just not the audience for that joke. Probably your wife is the audience for that joke.
No, it's what we actually want to hear, so it's not funny.
Confirmation bias. Yeah. My favorite thing. So I got into podcasts because, well, with my first child, I was breastfeeding with both hands. They were like literal handfuls, like baby in one hand, like boob squeezing in the other hand. And so and you have to keep your eyes on your kids or else they'll take you to prison and stuff. So I started listening to podcasts just like hours and hours and hours a day. I was listening to podcasts. I got super into them. I literally had a list of, I think, almost 200 podcast ideas when about a year and a half ago, Spotify put out a call for ideas for its first Spotify SoundUp Bootcamp, which was to encourage women of color podcasters to get into the space and increase representation in media. Because I can't remember where I read this. I think it was like that Einstein or whatever that group. Edison Research, yeah. There was a few years ago they don't count this. They don't do demographics of podcasters every year. But the last year they did it, it was something like 68% of podcasters are white men.
Hello. That was me.
Two-thirds of this room are white men.
No, I'm Hispanic. It's okay.
And then it would go down to something like 12 or 14% or 15% were white women. And then something like that, like 12 or 14 or 15% were men of color. And then it was another full fourfold decrease to something like 3.7 or 3.8% women of color. And so they put out this initiative to say, like, even if you're a total beginner, even if you haven't even started, if you fill out this application, it's a good application, you know, it has nothing to do with your credentials. It didn't have any of those kinds of things. It was just, what is your idea? Can you explain your idea? And then only, and then over 18,000 women applied, and only 10, there were only 10 slots, but I did get one of them. But even before I found out that I got one of them, because there was a hiccup with their, they did not expect to get so many applications, obviously. So they had to delay by a lot when they were going to notify people if they were finalists, and then interview the finalists to figure out who the last 10 were going to be. But no, but they didn't, they weren't able to notify people that that was going to happen in advance. So on the day that they were supposed to tell people, all these people went out on the internet using the hashtag, hashtag Spotify Sound Up Bootcamp or something like that. Sound Up Bootcamp. I can't remember. It's been so long now. But we all got online trying to figure out what was going on with our applications and whether or not we got in. And all these women got together and we said, wait, holy crap. We didn't know there were so many other women of color who were passionate about storytelling who wanted to do this. And we just kind of formed our own group. So if you're listening, you're a woman of color podcaster, you should definitely join WOC Podcasters on Facebook. And in the questions about how you heard about it, definitely say, I heard Ivy on Create Pod. And then whoever's, you know, able to field the request that day, if it's not me, then one of the other mods will know. And then, you know, we'll let you into the group. It's not that hard to get in the group. Nice. Awesome. Welcome, everybody. So that's how I got started, is when that happened and I saw that there were all these people, I just said, you know, that's enough. Like, I'm enough. Like, I do not need to wait for someone to give me permission to do this, you know? And I started making terrible demos and terrible pilots and doing research and concept episodes about a year and a half ago. And then about a year ago, I got out of the Sound Ops, the boot camp experience. And here we are.
What was the bootcamp experience like? What did you learn there? How is that influencing what you do now?
The biggest takeaway for me was this incredible room full of women of color who were just, I mean, exploding with stories, who have just been so supportive and are just going to be lifelong friends. And it's really hard. We were just talking about this earlier today. It's really hard to find community sometimes because, you know, podcasters are a really diverse group, and some podcasters are doing it as just a marketing tool for their business. Or some podcasters are doing it because they're, like, say they're like comedians and they you know, want to have a platform for their comedy, right? Or they're doing like live play games, and like that's like a whole different niche, you know. So to find community with people who are caring about the same things as me, that's really hard for me to find. Like, no one in my family even understands what I do for a living, you know. They've never understood any of the things that I do for a living. So like even at home, like, I've always been kind of, you know, I read a little eccentric, and so it's hard to find community. And that's been the biggest thing. It's just having people who understand kind of what my goals are. But the boot camp itself was a crash course over the course of a week about, you know, most issues that podcasters care about, like, what's legal, how do you use music legally, how do you craft a story, you know? Mm-hmm. And there was like a lot of meeting. There were a lot of like little mini workshops given by people in the podcasting industry in the New York area, because that's where it was. And it was super intense. And it was really focused on the pitch. I think a lot of independent podcasters don't know that a lot of these really, really big podcasts that you're listening to, they're pitched kind of like how TV shows are pitched to networks. So they'll like create the concept, refine-tune the pitch, maybe make a pilot episode, and then take that whole package and propose it to a network, to a podcast network, to get acquired or to be partnered with them, you know. And so it was really focused on that route. And I didn't end up winning one of the, you know, the seed money kind of prizes. And so I went the independent route and ended up funding my podcast with Kickstarter.
You want a spot in the boot camp. And so there was something about your pitch that got you in. What goes into a good podcast pitch?
So I think they want to hear your unique voice, because really almost any idea you come up with is like probably not going to be that original an idea, right? Any podcast that you listen to that you love, there are probably other podcasts that are kind of in that neighborhood. So they want to get an idea of the host's voice, right?
And when we're talking about that, we're talking about potential financial backers.
Right.
Or a network.
Right.
Okay.
Or, and I think some networks are, they function more like cooperatives where you're just pooling marketing resources and you're pooling sales, you know, ad sales resources and things like that. But they're not, but it's more, yeah, it's more like a co-op than it is a network. So it just depends on the network that you're pitching, right? So you people want to know, do you have a really clear concept? Do you know, do you have, is there like a hook? Is there a reason for people to listen? Is it unique in any way? What is your voice? Like, can you actually follow through on the things that you're promising the network? You know, I think just the way that you would consider, you would think of any pitch, whether it's a business pitch or a film pitch or a TV pitch or a radio pitch, you know, it's just basically like, okay, like how much do I want this? And even if I do want this, like, are you actually going to give it to me if I do, if I uphold my end of the bargain?
So you finance independently. You ran a Kickstarter. Can you tell me how much was your goal, and what did you grab?
My goal was like, if I could get $7,500, and obviously a stretch goal was like $10,000.
Yeah.
But on Kickstarter, right, if you don't meet your stated goal, then you don't get any of the money. So our stated goal was something like $1,500, and I raised a little shy of $6,000.
Wow. What was your strategy behind that? I know that's a pretty broad question, but just walk me through it. From creating content for the Kickstarter to getting the word out there to getting to that goal. How did all that happen?
How the Kickstarter fits into my big picture strategy is that was really the first big marketing campaign to let people know that FOGO exists, to let people, get people excited about the concept itself, right? And obviously the money was the primary goal because I literally did not have any equipment yet. I really did need the money for the equipment. But kind of long term, I thought of it as a marketing strategy. So from it, I got, you know, a couple hundred emails of people who were super enthusiastic. I got so many people who were sending me amazing story ideas, you know. So there were those secondary benefits as well. But the strategy was really it was just like the pitch. I didn't really think of a Kickstarter video and all of the Kickstarter materials as really any different from a pitch to a network, because I'm still pitching people for their money, right? So,
sure.
So I'm like, I still said, hey, here's this really unique idea. This is my perspective and my voice. And please give me money to be a part of it, to be a part of making this thing that I hope you will find really compelling. And what I found was that about half of the people who will open up their wallets, there are a lot of people who support you, but not like open, type in their credit card, create a username on the website, you know, create the secure password, like do everything you have to do to donate, right?
Thanks for liking my page. Give me money.
You're right. So people have to be really, really passionate. You know, those kinds of fans are really precious fans. So somebody to open up their wallet and create a username and give you, you know, and give you their email and everything. That's a really serious fan. And the fans of FOGO, I call them Fofogos, but it's not a thing yet. I just call it that. No one else is calling fans of FOGO Fofogos yet, but maybe after this interview they will.
It'll catch on.
Thanks, fan.
We'll do a hashtag.
Okay. Half the people are like me. They hate the outdoors. They're extremely skeptical of people who go outdoors and are pleased that their perspective is going to be represented, because you see these people on TV and they're going outdoors and they're just like, oh, no big deal. I'll just whip this mangle wire out of my boot and catch this, you know, pigeon, and somehow feed a crew of seven people with it, with the fire that I made by putting these two rocks together that were just convenient. One of them is conveniently flint, right? Yeah. Like, right, like it doesn't seem.
How do you do that?
Right. It's not that it seems impossible. It just seems like if you're a skeptical person. You want your skepticisms addressed.
Sure.
right, to make something believable. Yeah. So like a great podcast interview, for example, a great radio interview, like Terry Gross got really famous because Terry Gross will interview somebody and then they'll say something. And then the question that you're thinking in response to the interview subject's, you know,
that's what she asks.
She literally, that's the next question she asks, is mm-hmm. literally what was in your brain. And yeah. you're like, thank you, right?
We're not going to do that. Yeah. We're not Terry Gross.
What is your favorite color?
So people, you know, so there are a lot of people like me who are like, yes, I want somebody who has my perspective to go outside and ask the questions that I would ask before I'm willing to try this, right? And no one else is. I say all the time, like, the FOGO, Fear of Going Outside. It's a nature show by the most reluctant host ever, which isn't saying much because most nature shows are hosted by reckless white men. And that's all I'll say about that because I have found it's extremely taboo to make jokes about Steve Irwin. So.
right. Too soon still.
Learn that the hard way. But.
Jokes like, for example.
Go on.
And the other half is actually people who are so into the outdoors that they cannot possibly believe that people like me really exist. And they think I'm portraying a character who is absurd and hilarious.
Right.
I did not see that audience coming at all.
the skeptical assholes? There's a plenty of them.
Right. I know lots of everybody in my circles is like, oh yes, I'm also afraid of the outdoors. I'm so glad you're doing this, right? But I didn't have personal access to the people who are super into the outdoors until my campaign posted, and then all these people that I didn't even know were giving this campaign and posting on Facebook being like, I am head of such and such a Girl Scout troop, and that's so great that you're doing this. You know, like our troops are, you know, our trooper, I don't know, our scouts are, you know, would love to teach you a thing or two about the outdoors and hope that you learn to enjoy the outdoors as much as we do. You know, just like just really sweet comments. Like somebody taught me, they were like, oh, you should do an episode about dog sledding in Alaska. And I was like, I don't understand. Is that like a... Is people are still using it as transportation or what's going on? And she explained it's like a whole like ordeal. And I totally want to do it now because I love puppers, you know, so I totally want to do that. I'm super scared of the cold. It'll be a ways, I think, you know, it's definitely bucket list that like the tourism department of Alaska will like let me go spend a week with a bunch of cute dogs, you know. But it'll be like so much budget. I'll have like a whole team, just like a personal heater, like the whole time, you know, like a diva, just like sledding in Alaska.
Just glamping out there with pulling you along. Yeah.
Right. And then whenever it's time to record, like we just take all that away and just like put ice in my hair. And I'm like, this is terrible. You know, like that's the dream. That's the dream, to live that life.
The camera needs to be rolling as you pull away the tent. Yes. Oh, it is miserable out here. Me and Bear Grylls are both just struggling out here.
Struggling. So you like nibble on our caviar, right?
So when you made the Patreon video, it is it's a great video. It's very funny. It's a fantastic pitch for it, and how you play with everything visually. It's interesting because your podcast is going to be audio. Are you going to still be incorporating video elements, like a visual component?
I do try to post video on social media, real talk, you know, my long-term goal as an artist is not to be known as, like, the nature girl, right?
Right.
Like the city slicker, the city mouse outdoors, like, that's not my ultimate long-term goal. I absolutely want FOGO to be a television show, but in order for me to even make it a YouTube show, I would have had to raise, I mean, probably 4, 5, 6 times what I was able to raise. So for me as an artist, podcasting is this amazing place to try out concepts, but within my means.
Right.
Right.
Well, then that kind of makes you, like, if your vision is to have something that ultimately could also play very visually, how do you explore that within just the audible world, I guess? Like, how are you trying to kind of portray this story of what it's like the struggle with going outdoors. Right. You know, just talking about it, I guess.
So when we go out in the field, everyone, like the person I'm interviewing and I, we are mic'd up with lavalier mics. Mm. So I don't use any USB mics because I don't really have an opportunity to sit right very often. Like I have a little studio in my closet that I made with just these little foam, you know, these little foam panels you got on Amazon. I cleaned out half my closet and I stuck a bunch of foam panels up. And I'll use that space to record voiceovers. For example, like what you hear in the trailer, a lot of that was just recorded in my closet studio. But outside, everyone's lavved up as if they're on TV because I want that intimacy, right? And then the nature sounds, I have a separate boom mic that I use to record nature sounds. And I, when I'm smart, after my first few trips outside, once I really got smart, I would take time, once the guest was done, right? I would take time to collect these nature sounds or like warn the guest, like, hey, I might have to stop us talking, like if something really cool happens, like this bird you're talking about goes, or you know, the rocks start falling on us, I want to be sure to record our demise for the broadcast, obviously. And so that's how I get that intimacy, that reaction. Fogo is, for all intents and purposes, it's a reality show, right? It's an audio reality show, basically. Sure. Right, I'm going outdoors and pretty much almost everybody in my core audience, half my core audience, and it's like, it's not the same half, right? But a lot of people who gave to my Kickstarter, they're not doing it because they want me to grow and become this outdoor person. Half of the people are gave to my Kickstarter because they really want me to not grow at all, which is perfect because I also hate growth. Growing is terrible. My least favorite thing, the thing I hope never happens to me, is to find out what I'm made of.
It is hard.
You don't want to test your mettle there.
No, I don't. You know, I was, my parents did that whole refugee thing. I was the first person born in America. And, you know, though I've had my challenges, I was not running from communists. You know what I mean? It would have been terrible. My family line would have just ended. I would have been like, I would just rolled over. And I would just been like, fucking shoot me. I did not sign up for a goddamn 5K. Okay. No, that's not who I am.
Yeah.
Okay. But to me, there's like a whole journey inherent in Fogo that, that can be caught in voiceover, that to give that context, that full context that maybe you're thinking about in that it would be in a visual medium.
Well, to build the atmosphere, what you're talking about. Yeah. That was perfectly what I was curious about. Yeah.
I do like a cold open kind of each episode where that gives an anecdote that I'm not somebody who's trying to be funny on purpose. I just try to tell the truth as best as I can. And I think some percentage of people, when I make a post like that or something, some percentage of people will find it hilarious. And then some percentage of people will find it extremely tragic and emotional. And so that's fine. That's fine. I can just be me, right? Yeah. So we have like a cold open that is equal parts tragedy and humor that I think kind of sets the stage of who I am, so that even if you're not someone who knows me personally, you'll be able to understand the context of why I react the way that I react as things happen to me over the course of the episode.
So you're out in the field, you're collecting all this tape, the interview, the ambient sounds out there in the scary wilderness, and you're also doing narration in your little closet studio. You've told me before that this is a narrative comedy podcast. What are the challenges of, when you gather all that tape, putting it together and making it funny?
Well, first, I had to get over the challenge of trying to be funny on purpose. Once I started trying to be funny on purpose, everything, the entire process was just paralyzed. Everything stopped. Writing stopped. Wow. Recording stopped. Editing stopped. Concepts stopped. Everything stopped. And it stopped for kind of a long time. That was probably a month and a half.
You're just trying to write jokes and make it
funny. Yeah, I was just trying too hard to be funny. Once somebody told me that I was a comedian, that was just like the worst thing to happen to me ever. It was this January. So I raised money, it's like October, November, you know? And I know that I use dry wit to deal with things that I don't actually want to deal with, obviously, right? Like, I think that's like everybody probably, right? But I wouldn't call that being a comedian. I just call that just healthy coping mechanisms, sure. Right? So when somebody told me I was a comedian in January, I had been so unemployed for so long that I was like, you know what? If people are willing to pay to see me talk about my life, like, I really, I'm just out of career ideas at this point, and I just need, I'm going to try it. I'm not in a position to turn out any career ideas. It was after I did, I told a story about sexuality after childbirth at this storytelling show here in town called Bedpost Confessions. That's when people were like, oh, where I watch comedy all the time. I haven't seen one of your shows. Like, people were not like, you should try comedy. They assumed that I was employed, mm-hmm. and I was a professional comedian, and no one had given me that, you know, the validation yeah. that you need when you grow up in a capitalist society, like, in a really long time. And so I was like, I guess I'm a comedian now. And I started trying to write Fogo in a funny on purpose kind of way. And it was a disaster. On top of all the normal delays that you get when you're starting out creating your first podcast, like, gosh, there are so many guests that I booked that at the last minute would bail because something would come up that was more important than a podcast they've never heard of, which is literally anything could come up. Everything is more important mm-hmm. than being on a podcast you've never heard of.
Yeah.
Right. That cost. God, so many delays.
We're happy you're here today. We're lucky. Yeah.
Is that something you guys have experienced?
Of course.
You guys are seasoned podcasters.
Yeah, it happens.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember after I was able to get the funds paid out from Kickstarter, and I started to try to buy equipment. I first started trying to buy all the equipment that all the other podcasters like told me to get, and like none of it works for me. None of it works for me. There was just no one else. No one else like doing quite as much field recording as I was, and so no one was able to help me with that, and it just required a lot of trial and error, which I don't like going outside. So every time I would get new equipment, and I would have to like psych myself up to go outside and do real recording, not just like testing 1-3, jump back in the house, you know,
right.
But like really like. Try to record various sounds, like try to sound, say enough to see if it can handle all the consonants. And I don't know, I'm making this up. I don't really know anything about sound equipment, right? I just found equipment that worked for me. They're all Zoom mics. Everything I have is basically a Zoom mic. So I got all of these Zoom mics and that actually are marketed normally for like TV reporters, because TV reporters have to run out in the field. And a lot of times with all these like newsroom budgets getting cut, mm-hmm. it's one person that has to be like the camera and the interviewer and, you know, setting up everything and the producer. It's just like one. A lot of these are just like one person teams going out. So a lot of this equipment was marketed to them. And so it took me a while because they weren't being marketed to podcasters. It took me a while to find it. So like that took a whole lot of time to figure out just what my tech and equipment, you know, setup was. And then my software setup, when you go on YouTube and you look for software, right, software tutorials for podcasters, you know, it's a lot of mansplaining.
Sure.
There's
yeah.
a lot of mansplaining, mm-hmm. Like wordy YouTube tutorials that really just focuses on that group of podcasters that is like, I am so funny, and my friends are so funny.
The four guys, one brain.
If we just all sit around a bunch of mics and like talk for 2 hours and post it with almost no editing. Just a little editing to make us sound even manlier than we obviously already are.
That's like half my podcast idea.
It's just, but you know, but you own it. And I love that about you.
But you're trying to tell a story.
Right. Like I'm trying to tell a story, and none of these people doing these tutorials were teaching software to that end.
Right.
So like trying to figure out, I feel like I had to figure that out all on my own. Like, so at Spotify, one of the things that we did get is Hindenburg donated mm-hmm. for all 10 of us, not just the winners. Hindenburg donated a subscription for everybody that participated in the Spotify bootcamp. So I started doing the Hindenburg tutorials to just start, to just like have a tutorial that was like actually tailored to storytellers. So for those of you who don't know, Hindenburg is an audio editing software that is targeted specifically to radio journalists. Like that kind of, and which of course now that also applies to a lot of podcasters. A lot of the same things that they need, podcasters need, right? As opposed to, you know, audio software that is just targeted for like everybody or for musicians, you know, or for whatever. So, or for people who are making film, right? Hindenburg is specifically tailored for radio type people. So I was able to start kind of taking baby steps. And I recorded not Fogo episodes, like one. I mic'd myself up with my equipment to do a lot of block walking for during the election season that year for a candidate that's in my district. Mm-hmm. And I did a training and I recorded all of it so I could make a little mini podcast that was just to let other people who were thinking about doing a training in a block walk to just hear it and be like, okay, this is what it sounds like. These are some things that I can say. It's not that scary knocking on doors of strangers. Most of them are actually really nice, you know, and just have that experience and like listen to it. And almost no one listened to that, but I was able to take this super long file and like cut out the silence and cut out, you know,
I just did practice.
Right. I made little mini episodes of whatever I could get sound of to try to figure out how to use that. And so that learning process is a whole right thing. And then
it's
a lot.
It's fascinating because you're going through all these different, like, various approaches to podcasting. And some of these are, you know, very familiar to me. Other ones are, like, areas I've never even thought to kind of explore. Like, you know, like, preparing and making a pitch to someone else and trying to sell an idea of a podcast in advance is, it's intimidating, but it's also very exciting, that kind of process.
It is, because if you think that if you get a partner, I actually got an email back. So an email back from a really cool network recently. It said that they're like, this is really on brand for us. And I was just like waiting to for real to hear back.
Nice.
But I'm still going to, you know, but I'm not going to put all my eggs in one basket. I'm still going to pitch a whole lot of networks. You know, I'm targeting medium sized comedy networks. Because I think that they'll understand what it is that I'm trying to do, even if they don't have a show that's like exactly like mine. Because I can't think of another show that's exactly like mine right now, right?
Yeah.
But I think that those networks will treat my show right because they understand what it is that I'm trying to achieve. You have to make, you know, you have to do like your in-person pitch. Then there's like some people who, you know, want it in like a PowerPoint form so that they can just forward the email to somebody in development at their network, you know. And then you actually just need the email pitch like written out. That's really intimidating because you're like, oh, like they can't hear my voice. They can't hear my excitement. Like it's just words on a page to a stranger. Not even a page, words on a screen to a stranger in an email box that's probably just full of tons of strangers asking them for things, right? So there are all these pieces, but as long as you can get kind of your first story down, it's a starting point to kind of tackle these other forms of the same pitch.
So you have a very like structured and like written out idea framework for your podcast then.
You mean the structure for each episode?
For each episode.
Yeah. And I have like a whole narrative like arc for the entire season. And that was because I wasn't able to raise the kind of money that I would need to make like my perfect idea of Fogo would be a lot like that show Reply All. Gimlet
show?
It's
my favorite show. Yeah.
It's definitely, you know, my top three. For a long time, it's my favorite show. But I've actually been like listening to Heavyweight episodes over and over and over and over again because Heavyweight is a show with a single host, as opposed to Reply All, which has two hosts, a single host whose personality affects the outcome of the story.
Uh-huh.
Right. So when I first started getting writer's block and not trying to just being overwhelmed by the immensity of what I was trying to write to script Fogo, I would literally listen to Heavyweight episodes, my favorite Heavyweight episodes again, with my notebook open and my phone in front of me so that I could see the timestamps. And I would literally write each scene down in the timestamp. So I could go back and be like, oh, act one was approximately 19 minutes or whatever, right? And then this was an ad break. And then act two, this is what happened, you know, and then these were the scenes, how he built this. And then he put this, and he pulled this person's voice back, and, you know, and I did that for several, I mean, probably, I don't know, three or four heavyweight episodes before I was like, I think I'm beginning to understand what it is about this that makes me want to listen to it. And now I can go back and write the scenes and figure out what the arc is for Fogo. But what I wanted was each episode to be a completely different adventure. But that requires Gimlet money. Right? Like, I do not have Gimlet money, right?
Right.
So I said, these people have trusted me with their money, and they expect something from it. Roman Mars has said in interviews about podcasting, he said, all money comes with strings attached. But the only strings that matter is from your actual listeners. So if your listeners give you money and there's strings attached, like those matter. All the other strings, kind of avoid them if you can, right? But your listeners, what they want is what you should be wanting, right? So I thought to myself, what is the best show that I could make for under $6,000 that will make people who open their wallets for Fogo, will make them feel like they got what was promised to them, right? So in the Kickstarter, there were on the text on the page, not in the video, there were ideas of like, these are the kinds of episodes I'm trying to make. And I could not make those episodes. I do not have the budget for them. So instead, all of season one is one narrative arc where I go through all the steps it takes to figure out how to go camping. And then the season finale, I literally go camping. I went in July this year. I literally went camping.
Where'd you go? Oh, the best time to go in Texas.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Of course.
Where did you go?
Yeah. I went to Inks Lake Park, about an hour and change outside of Austin.
Oh, it's supposed to be really pretty out there though.
Sure.
For a person who likes nature, I guess.
I definitely have some injuries still that flare up when the moon is full, and I am probably going to be paying for that for a really
long time. That's a werewolf bite.
Yeah. Long time.
You're turning into a werewolf.
Yeah, we have a silver bullet, and we're going to kill you now.
Put me out of my misery.
It's a mercy kill.
As of this recording, your show's not out yet. So how far are you into the process of producing everything, getting all the tape?
So I've collected all of the field tape. All the field tests have been collected for a while, but it's taken a long time to review. You know, you have to sync all the tape because right, everybody's on a different mic. All the sounds are on a different mic. It takes forever to sync everything up, and then I put all of the synced files through otter.ai. which is kind of this automatic transcription service. So there's lots of errors because a computer does it, but it's just the best priced one out there that I could find because I want my show to be funny at parts, right? Or like emotionally resonant at parts. But a lot of these more, I guess, journalistic storytelling shows, they can get away with being like, this scene is about this. But if you're talking about comedy, if you want people to laugh at certain parts, the exact wording matters. The exact timing matters. And so I run everything through otter.ai to get the transcript. And then because it's not perfect, because it's computer generated, right, then I go back through and listen to everything and edit as I listen. And that's kind of my first chance to like really understand what tape I have, you know, in terms of the words, not the sounds, but in terms of the words. And then I pick out what are just really emotionally resonant scenes, whether they're, you know, funny or sad, or, you know, funny to some people, sad to other people, right? I just take out what I think is emotionally resonant and what is emotionally true. And then I put those in a Word document. And then I can read over those and start to understand and piece together the scenes for the narrative arc of each episode that leads me to the ultimate, right, the season finale where I'm actually able to go camping. I think people don't understand how difficult it is to go camping if you've never, I've been camping once, but someone else planned the whole thing. And I was just along for the ride. I was like miserable. And I was just along, but I was along for the ride. I didn't understand how difficult it was to actually put it together. And I don't think the person who planned that trip thought it was difficult because they grew up doing it. So they just did what their parents did, you know? Right. So I have to figure out, how do you figure out where to go? Honest to God, true story, nothing is really made up for the sake of comedy. It is just the truth, right? I looked up, I Googled, just like any normal person trying to figure out how to go camping. I Googled, okay, nature store. How do I get stuff for nature? I Googled nature store. And no nature stores came up. Only hippie grocery stores came up.
Right.
So I'm like, I don't even know what to Google at this point.
So right? You're at the green grocer on the east side, like, where are your tents?
Yeah. Like, this is
REI's
not a
right across the street. Yeah.
Like, is that what that is?
REI, yeah.
So is it not called a nature store? Whatever, we can save that for the show. Okay, so
I figured it out.
Outdoor and sporting store. Yeah.
Okay, so it's like you would have to drive to an REI to figure out what your search terms are. Like, that's not, no one's first thing is, I'm going to go camping. I'm going to go get in my car and go drive to REI. That's no one's like first step, right? So the first episode, I actually don't go outside. The first episode is me talking to people who are my close friends, trying to figure out, like, do you know anything about this? And, you know, what advice do you give? Trying to figure out what it is that I don't know so that I can start to learn what it is that I don't know, to learn about those things, right? And so then there are, like, experts. Like, I interviewed this horticulturalist / lepidopterist at the State Botanical Gardens. Lepidoptery is the study of butterflies and moths, those animals, whatever. And she literally put me through a gauntlet of, like, spiders and carpenter bees. I was so genuinely traumatized and exhausted afterwards that I fell asleep on the road and I had to pull over on the side of the highway. It is only, like, 20 some odd minutes from home, and I had to pull over. I was so just physically, emotionally, mentally spent from the stress of being outdoors for like 2.5 hours. Like, she showed me a snake that was actively eating a rat that it had just eaten. That was just like, it wasn't an exhibit. It was just like on the grounds. Okay.
The next episode is your trauma therapy.
And there is an episode where I talk to a therapist.
Okay.
About all these things and you know, trying to keep my brain, like, together and mentally prepared to go outside. So I have to get physically prepared to go outside. I have to go figure out, like, what my food situation in this place I've never been is going to be like.
Yeah.
I have to figure out where to go, how to figure out where to go. Turns out you have to book it online, like Airbnb. You can't just go outside. You have to, like, go online and fill out your address and your credit card information and, you know, like a square, right? Like, it is not what I thought it was at all. And what I come to learn, is there is this very culturally specific constructed idea of the outdoors. And no, I don't fit in that. I, in fact, was the only person of color staying overnight that I saw at East Lake State Park the time that I went there to camp over several nights. And it is true. There are very valid reasons why people like me do not feel like we belong there. At the same time, that is not the only way to relate to the outdoors at all, right? And that everybody's culturally specific ways of relating to the outdoors are valid, and that everyone's experiences, even if you did not grow up camping, whatever experiences you did have, you will draw from those to craft your survival or recreation, depending on your perspective, right? Outdoors. And that they are also valid, and you can dress the way that you want, even if, you know, like, there are definitely people. After my Kickstarter video posted, so many people sent me messages of unsolicited advice being like, you're not supposed to wear open-toed shoes outdoors. I was wearing white Birkenstocks. I thought those were outdoor shoes. Right. I've only seen outdoor people wear Birkenstocks until it got, like, off-duty model cool, which is when I got into my white patent leather Birkenstocks, right? So those are literally the most outdoorsy shoes that I own, as far as I know. And all these people were like, you're not supposed to wear those shoes outside. I'm like, I don't know what I'm supposed to wear outside. And then finally, now I'm just like, yeah, I wore my Birkenstocks the entire time.
That's what I wear.
Outside. Yeah. Lots of people do it. But there's kind of this subculture where people are like, no, you're supposed to wear this and that and the other thing, and you're supposed to have exactly this and this equipment. It makes people feel like if they are not able to access those things, or if they're not already in the know, right, it's just this, it makes them feel like they're not welcome, or they're not supposed to be there, or they're not, you know, they're not going to do well They're like, they just got out of their car and somebody's like, you're not going to do well out here, you know?
Just the very nature of you doing a type of show where you don't know something invites everyone else to become an expert and want to tell you, you have to do it like this. You have to understand it like that. Yeah.
And also what you're doing is great because it invites a forum to where we can question and hopefully one day destroy that kind of destructive guardian culture that keeps people away from activities like this, where it maybe the way it's been constructed for generations doesn't really fit what a certain culture would want to do, even though that should be available to them. Going camping should be available to everybody, and there shouldn't be this culture of, no, you don't do it that way. That keeps people out.
It's partly the culture, but there's lots of other things that kind of keep people out too, like physical access, for example. Definitely like wealthier parts of the country and even our city, right, have more access to just public parks, like playgrounds, you know, like regular old parks, like urban parks are more plentiful in, you know, places that have more already, right? And I took care to, because, right, I care about representation in media. I took care to make sure that I found diverse interview subjects that were going to give me diverse perspectives. And one of just the best interviews, which becomes a turning point, it was a genuine turning point in my perspective and a genuine turning point in the arc of the show, was this woman, Rocio, she works at this nonprofit in town that helps introduce children to the outdoors. And they bring this programming to schools, and they oversee this this preserve, this kind of nature preserve, like in town. And she's also an ambassador for an organization of people that promotes indigenous people going outdoors. So she herself and her mother, her parents immigrated from Mexico, and one of her parents is indigenous. And she took me on this hike on the Greenbelt in Austin. She took me to a place on the Greenbelt where she says, actually here where you see all this water, they have found artifacts from more than 10,000 years ago, human artifacts from over 10,000 years ago, right here in this spot. So this idea that a certain kind of person goes hiking on the Greenbelt, right? Like this stereotype of an Austinite that is super comfortable in the outdoors and like has all the right clothes and all the right shoes and, you know, does this for fun on the weekends. I literally saw a dude on a unicycle on the Greenbelt the day that she took me. Okay. We were sitting on this quiet rock. He had the handlebar mustache and everything.
Right.
Like, hang out with his buddies and their dogs. Like, literally that. I really saw that with my own eyes. I wish to God I had gotten a picture. Because, like, no, only people who live here believe me that that happened.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
You know that it happened because you live here, right?
But I know those guys.
And I don't even know how he got it into that part of the Greenbelt because it was really rainy and muddy and wet that day. Anyway, so we were sitting in this quiet spot and she says, here, they found artifacts over 10,000 years old. And she said, a lot of people think that they're not nature people. And she grew up thinking that way too because she's from East Austin and there wasn't a lot of places to go outside and they were inside all the time. Very much the way I grew up, it was not safe for us to go outside where I grew up. I tried once to run around my block and I came home and I passed out. I had to call 911. I guess it was like some chemicals on the lawns or something, but also just dangerous in terms of crime. Like my sister's gotten robbed in her own driveway, like in that neighborhood. It was just not a place that you would just send your kids out to play. It was just not something that a responsible parent would let their kids go do, right? And so she grew up in a place where, you know, they weren't driving. They couldn't just like run out to the botanical gardens or the Greenbelt from where she was living in East Austin when she was growing up. But now she says, look, you know, these plants and these animals around us, indigenous people had this. My mom had this. Someone in my mom's family had this, but then they transplanted us into a place where, no, we don't know what these plants and these animals do. You know, we don't know how they behave. We don't understand how to cultivate this land. And they moved us here on purpose. And this severed connection with nature is something that she reclaims when she goes outdoors.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
And I was like, whoa, that is true, right? Mm-hmm. My family immigrated here. They were forced. We were forced out. Like, there's like a push or pull. We were pushed out. We weren't trying to go to America to get the American dream, right? We would have loved to just stay home, right? Like,
right.
All right. So we were. I did lose this connection to like the earth and the plants and the animals, right? That had that we had knowledge of over generations and generations of people, and transplanted to a place where we didn't understand any of those things. So of course I didn't feel. Like, of course I'm afraid of all the plants. Of course I'm afraid of everything, you know, outside. I just personally, being a city person, I feel like any other human, even the most dangerous human, I have a chance because I understand that humans need water. I understand that humans get tired. I speak several languages. I understand how humans communicate, so I can negotiate. I can fight. I know what humans' weak spots are if I have to get into a physical altercation and talk myself, you know, talking myself out of it doesn't work or whatever, right? When I go out into the woods, I don't understand anything. Like, you could be a medicine that would be helpful to me, but like, I can't tell the difference between something that's helpful and something that's poisonous, right? I can't. People are like, oh, I got the advice so many times, like, oh, just watch out for snakes. As long as you watch out for them, they won't bother you. And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? How do you give a snake space? They camouflage themselves on purpose,
right?
I don't have snake vision. I'm from Dallas.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, that so many people gave me that advice. And then she was like, this is why I do this. I feel a sense of peace. I feel a connection to my past that was severed. I feel a connection to all of humanity going back tens of thousands of years. And it gives her that sense of, ironically, leaving the city where, you know, she is going to experience on a day-to-day basis, like, various shades, you know, usually like very like low grade microaggressions, right? Because of the color of her skin and her gender. But then she goes out into nature and she away from people or away from those constructs. And she actually ends up feeling much more connected to humanity. Mm-hmm. This like she can to this greater human experience that transcends our specific society and our specific time. And that changed my perspective a lot. So it's over the course of the season, I get like small changes like that, but then some episodes I come out of it and I'm like, that did not go well. And I do not feel more prepared at all, you know? And then some episodes I come out and I'm like, I genuinely have a different perspective and I am going to approach the next kind of step of preparation differently now.
Sounds like it was quite an experience.
So FOGO will eventually become LOGO, love of going outside.
I don't think love is probably what's going to happen.
Tolerance, Togo. Tolerance are going outside. Bare minimum tolerance.
Yeah.
I have a very high level of like, eh, fuck it. That's the American part of me. It's like, this is going to be horrible, but eh, fuck it.
Well, thank you so much for talking about your process with us. I mean, there's clear passion in it, even if there's trepidation in some of the steps. You throw yourself in there and you give a lot of passion to every step of this, and I think that shows through in this discussion, and I'm sure with the upcoming show, and we're very excited for it.
I'm glad you guys are sure.
No, I really admire all the work that you have done for the show. I mean, it just sounds so work intensive, but you are committed to it, you're passionate about it, and that is the type of person we like to get on the show in this studio. To learn from. So we appreciate it very much. Tell us where we can find you online.
You can actually subscribe to my show and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts because the trailer is live. Just search FOGO, F-O-G-O, and you'll see. You can also type in Fear of Going Outside. But FOGO, if you type in F-O-G-O, it should be one of the first results that come up. You can also get all of the bonus social media content by following me on Instagram at FOGO Podcast or on Facebook, also FOGO Podcast. But the best thing to do would be to go to the website, FOGOPodcast.com, and sign up to get the newsletter. Put it in your email, sign up to get the newsletter because it's not always dependable, you know, whether or not social media, whether or not Facebook or Instagram will let you know when a post has gone up.
All right, let's go outside.
Let's not.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot to Ivy for joining us here at the studio. That was a great interview. You can find her. What's her website, Grant?
It's fogopodcast.com. And yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, she's currently producing the first season, and she has a couple episodes out already. So check that out.
You should definitely check out that video that we're talking about, her little pitch video.
Oh, yeah. Again.
And yeah, if you guys want to check us out, we are once again at createpod.co, and we are recording this out of Permanent Record Studios here in lovely Austin, Texas. You can check out our podcast studio at permanentrcrd.com. Definitely stay tuned, guys. We'll be back next week with a roundtable discussion. Thanks.
Bye.
We love you.